Now, some say that the greatest miracle Jesus ever performed was putting up with his disciples. And if you think about the stories of the Gospels, there are so many of those where you almost get frustrated with the disciples because they blunder their way, they say the wrong thing, they don't get him. And then it culminates with, at the end of Jesus' life, they all desert him. And there's a part of looking at all of that where you think, how in the world did Jesus choose those 12 guys? I mean, never did 12 men change the course of the world like those 12 guys, but never did somebody have to put up with 12 guys that did exactly the opposite of what he wanted them to do. And, you know, it's not that we want to be critical of Jesus. I mean, far be it from us, but there's a part of us that think, why those guys? What did Jesus see in those guys that said, I want you and you and you and you? And then we think, well, did he choose the wrong guys? Did he, like, not interview them enough? Did he not check the references enough? In fact, in Mark 9, Jesus says, how long will I have to put up with you guys? And it's like what every parent thinks along the way as well. So, you know, Jesus was that kind of guy. And what he put up with his disciples is truly part of the story that I think is wonderful. You see, Jesus understands what it's like to have kids. And even if you think about how they would bicker back and forth, like the story of James and John, James and John are trying to get their mom to get Jesus to commit to one being on his left and one being on his right, and then all the disciples get mad at James and John for doing this, pretty much because they didn't think of it before he did. That's what Jesus had as he walked along with those guys. But there must have been something special. And despite of their blunders, their blindness to the truth, there was something in them. And I think when you look at these guys and their lives and what they did and what they didn't do, there's a part of us that feels like there's hope for people like us. People that are very, very imperfect. And we see Jesus choose these very imperfect men who then go on to change the world. Aren't we all glad that Jesus uses imperfect people? And one of the great stories of the disciples and Jesus choosing these disciples and all of their blunders and the craziness that they did is Jesus chose imperfect people and always has. One of the questions about these guys that people have been debating for, you know, 2,000 years is the question of why did Jesus choose 12? What's so magic about the number 12? I mean, certainly, as we talked about last week, when you look at the 12, you have Peter, James, and John that are kind of the inner circle with Jesus. Why didn't he just choose 3? Or why didn't he choose 7? We see the importance of 7, this perfect number, all the way throughout the scripture. Why not do 7? Why 12? And, you know, just from a quick review, it seems like 12 was an important number to Jesus. Like, he chose 12 on purpose, and then he insisted on maintaining the 12. At one point, he sends out 70 workers. And we know that there were other people, men and women, that followed Jesus along. Why didn't he choose 70? Why didn't he choose 82, 70 plus 12? Why didn't he just choose everyone? Why these men? Why 12? Why would he exclude 70, exclude the other ones to say, these are my people? And there's really, I think, probably not a really good answer. The most logical reason is 12 disciples and 12 tribes of Israel. And Jesus is coming along and he's establishing this new kingdom. And this new kingdom is going to supersede the old kingdom, but he maintains some part of the organizational structure that the Jews had with the 12 tribes. That would seem to be the most logical, but we really don't know. In fact, there are all kinds of 12 parallels, 12s that are used all the way throughout the Bible for all kinds of different things. For instance, when Israel comes into Canaan, they come into the Promised Land, they divide the land into 12 parts. When Joshua brings the men in and he establishes a leadership crew, he chooses 12 men. Who can guess how many gates they built coming into Jerusalem? 12. You guys are so smart. So we have all of these 12s, and we even have sometimes multiples of 12. Like when the Levites set up the order for the temple, there were 24 divisions for the work in the temple. Even in the future, in the book of Revelation, when we find in heaven, the division of the workers in heaven are 24 divisions. There are 24 elders. In fact, if you remember the 144,000 chosen at the end, that's 12,000 times 12. So we find this number 12 all the time throughout Scripture. And evidently, Jesus thought it was an important number. But what's really interesting is that there have been a lot of societies and a lot of religions that have used this multiple of 12 as a significant part of the foundation of who they are. Let me just kind of give you a quick review of some of them. The Babylonians divided the night sky into 12 signs of the zodiac. Odin, you know that god of the Viking god Norse, 12 sons. Buddhists say that life is divided into 12 stages. The Greeks believe that 12 gods inhabited and led from Mount Olympus. Remember Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls? Well, the whole Dead Sea Scrolls and the Qumran community that were a set-apart community waiting for the Messiah to come, they divided the leadership among 12 men. Even Muslims always have 12 ruling imams. And the list just goes on. And as I start looking at that, just the number of times that 12 comes up in not only Judaism, but in all of the other religions was fascinating to me. But it brings us back to the question, why did Jesus choose 12? And the answer is we don't know. He never tells us. But there seems to be a logical, symbolic relationship between the 12 disciples and the 12 tribes of Israel, the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. Beyond that, we don't know. Everything else is kind of speculation. What comes along with the choosing of the 12 is a second question that people have been asking, and that is the question related to the word apostle. These 12 men, Jesus said, not only are you part of my 12 chosen, my inner circle, but along the way, he not only chooses them, but in Luke 6, he says, I now name you, I call you apostles. Now, he didn't name the 70 apostles. He named the 12 apostles. He didn't name all the men and the women that were traveling along with him as apostles, only the 12. Only those guys were named apostles. So that term, apostle, is specifically given by Jesus to these 12 and to no one else. Now that's really significant. In fact, when we get to Acts chapter 1, remember in Acts chapter 1, Judas Iscariot dies. You get to Acts chapter 1, Peter says, hey, we need to get the number back up to 12, that number 12 being important. And he says, here's how we're going to find out who can be a candidate for apostleship, to be called one of the apostles. And in Luke 6, it says, in Acts chapter 1, it says this, may his camp, and I think I have it for you up here, may his camp become desolate, and let there be no one to dwell in it. And that's a quote from the Old Testament, from the Psalms. And let another take his office. So one of the men who have accompanied us during all the time the Lord Jesus went in and out among us, beginning from the baptism of John, that's when Jesus' ministry began, until the day that he was taken up from us, that's his ascension, one of these men must become with us a witness to his resurrection. And so as they looked around, probably at the 70 men that Jesus had sent out before, as they looked around, they realized that there were two men that were primary candidates, meaning that they were eyewitnesses from the moment of Jesus' baptism all the way through his ascension, 3 years of following Jesus, 3 years of not being called an apostle, but 3 years of following Jesus. One of those men qualifies to be a candidate to be called an apostle. And we're going to be looking at Matthias here in a little while. But of those two, they cast lots, and Matthias was chosen. So 12 is important. And the naming of those 12 as apostles. No one else was called apostle. None of the 70, none of the people going with Jesus. Only these 12 men. Now, just to take it to the next level, just for a second. We don't have a whole lot of time, but just for a second. We get to the letters of Paul. And one of the things that Paul does over and over and over in his letters is argue that he is qualified to be called an apostle. In 1 Corinthians 15, for instance, he's arguing that one of the reasons that he was an apostle and should be considered an apostle and therefore have the authority of an apostle is because he says in 1 Corinthians 15 and lots of other places, because I have seen the Lord. I'm an eyewitness to the Lord. And so Paul has to argue his apostolic position throughout his ministry because there were people saying, you know, you weren't there at his baptism and you weren't there at his ascension, so why do you think you're an apostle? So this eyewitness to Jesus is an important part of being called an apostle. So there, as you probably know, there are lots of denominations and parts of Christianity where they have men and women that are officially titled an apostle. And we don't have that in our own tradition. Nobody calls me apostle or anything like that, or bishop or any of those words, but specifically apostle. And I think that's good and proper because for two reasons. First of all, I think when you look at the New Testament, eyewitness to Jesus was an important qualification to be called an apostle. And I think that's significant. But second, I think it's significant that we understand that the apostles had authority, apostolic authority, that no one else had. And I think you muddy the water when you bring in this word apostle and use it as a title for someone here and now today when they obviously do not have the apostolic authority that these 12 men had. That's all significant. So as we continue today, remember last week we did four of these obscure disciples of Jesus. Today we move forward with five more, four of his disciples plus Matthias. And the first one we're going to talk about today is Philip. Now, when I say the word Philip, you got to make sure in your brain that you don't confuse Philip the evangelist with Philip the apostle. Those are two different guys. So in Acts chapter 6, in what is often called the first choosing of the deacons, the first seven of the men that were chosen as deacons, one of them was named Philip. And here's what it says in Acts chapter 6, verse 5. And what they said pleased the whole gathering, and they chose Stephen, a man full of faith and the Holy Spirit, Philip, Prochorus, Nicanor, Timon from Lion King, and Parmenas. So these are the seven that were chosen, and one of those seven was this guy named Philip the Evangelist. And the whole stories that we have in Acts are Philip the Evangelist, not Philip the Apostle. So these were two different guys. And the details, we don't have very many details really around Philip the Apostle, but one of the details that we have is that he was from Bethsaida, the same place that Peter and Andrew were from. They may have grown up together. They certainly would have known each other. They certainly would have known each other's families. So there's one part of the story where some men show up to talk to Jesus, and it says that they were from Bethsaida. And when they arrived to talk to Jesus, they sought out Philip to talk to him first. Why? Well, because he was from Bethsaida. It's kind of like going to your hometown. You look for people that you know. So Philip was from Bethsaida in the same way that Peter and Andrew were. His most notable moment really comes early in his time with Jesus. And if you go with me to John chapter 1, I want to show you Philip the Apostle's most notable moment. John 1. I'm going to begin reading in verse 43. John 1, 43. It says, "The next day Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, 'Follow me.' Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, 'We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph.' Nathanael said to him, 'Can anything good come out of Nazareth?' Philip said to him, 'Come and see.'" And then there's a story about Nathanael going there. So Philip, is part of the interesting story of Philip, is that early on in Jesus' ministry, when no one really knew who Jesus was, and many of the disciples were still kind of scratching their heads trying to figure out who Jesus was, clearly from the beginning, Philip knew exactly who Jesus was. He was the Messiah. He was the one that Moses told us would come. He was the one the prophets said would come. And now he is here. I have met him. Nathanael, my best friend, you got to come see this guy. He has fulfilled all that we are waiting for. The Messiah has come. And really, this is the notable moment for Philip, because he recognizes, perhaps earlier than anyone else, exactly who Jesus was. Just to help us understand a little bit, there's so much church history that goes along with all of these guys. But what happens when a lot of these guys die, over the last 2,000 years, their bones have been moved several different times. And Philip gives us a great example of that. We know where he died, and we know how many times we think his bones were moved. So let me read you an account of one of the historians about the bones of Philip. He wrote, "Most of the ancient documents state that Philip died in Hierapolis in the year 80 after Christ, when he was 85 years old. He died a martyr for his faith, crucified upside down like Peter. He was buried in Hierapolis. In the ancient necropolis of that city, an inscription was found that alludes to a church dedicated to Philip. On an unspecified date, Philip's body was taken to Constantinople to remove it from the danger of profanity by the barbarians. And in the sixth century, under Pope Pelagius, it was taken to Rome and buried next to the Apostle James in a church built for them. That Byzantine-style church, then called the Church of Saints James and Philip, was rebuilt and transformed in 1500 into a new Renaissance church, which is presently called the Church of the Holy Apostles, where the bones of Philip were then moved and are buried today." The poor guy's bones were moved all around. But that's what happened with many of these guys. They would die in a certain spot, and for sometimes holy reasons, sometimes pilgrimage reasons, sometimes just to save their bones from desecration, they would get moved around. But nearly all of their bones at the end came to rest in the city of Rome. Well, now that we've talked about Philip just a little bit, let's talk about Nathanael. Since Philip brought Nathanael to Jesus, let's talk about him. And let's look back in the text, same text here in John 1, 46. This is where we are introduced to Nathanael by Philip. Verse 46 again, "Nathanael said to him, 'Can anything good come out of Nazareth?' Philip said, 'Come and see.'" Verse 47, "Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said of him, 'Behold an Israelite indeed in whom there is no deceit.' Nathanael said to him, 'How do you know me?' Jesus answered him, 'Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you.' Philip answered him, 'Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel.' Jesus answered him, 'Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these.' And he said to him, 'Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man.'" Now, as I mentioned last week, just really briefly, Nathanael has another name that he goes by in the New Testament. And his other name is Bartholomew. And Bartholomew is a transliteration of his Aramaic last name, Bartholomai, transliterated Bartholomew. So his real name, his maybe whole name we would say, would be Nathanael Bartholomew, or Nathanael Bartholomai. And it's a good thing that we know that, because Bartholomew, the name Bartholomew, only shows up in a few of our lists of disciples and nowhere else. But because we know that Bartholomew and Nathanael were the same guy, we know a few things. We know that he was brought to Jesus by Philip, and that Jesus made that famous exclamation about him, "Here is a man, here is an Israelite in whom there is no guile." Now, if you just pause for a second and let this proclamation by Jesus just sink in for a second. Jesus, the perfect Son of God, with all the power of the universe and all knowledge, looked into the heart of Nathanael and said, "There is no guile there." Now, I can't, off the top of my head, really think of a time in the rest of the New Testament where a single apostle is praised by Jesus like Nathanael was here at the beginning. In his heart, there is no guile at all. We also know that after Jesus was crucified, obviously he rose again, but then there was this period of time when many of the disciples didn't know what to do, so they went back to their former life. And we know that Philip joined Andrew and Peter and James and John, and he went back fishing after Jesus died in John 21. But given all that scant information, of his death seems really iconic. And I have a picture for you up there. And if you could turn down the lights up there just for a second so you can see this picture. Tradition, and all of these guys have so much tradition around them. And Nathanael, Bartholomew is one of those. But by tradition, Nathanael was filleted alive. And so a lot of the pictures, the iconic pictures that we have of Bartholomew, he's often wearing his skin. And what you can tell if you look closely, those are his feet hanging on the skin there. That's his skin he is wearing around him. Part of the tradition around his death was that he was filleted alive. The other part of the tradition says that Philip and Nathanael, who were best friends, Philip bringing Nathanael to Christ, that the two of them were arrested together. They were crucified upside down for 3 days together. The whole time, Philip was begging that the magistrate would release Nathanael. The magistrate did not release him, and they died there probably together. And I think when we consider how many of these disciples died as martyrs, we got to realize that every one of them was an eyewitness to Jesus. And think of all those stories and all those miracles and all those sermons of Jesus that you know so well. These guys, Philip and Nathanael, they sat and they watched and they listened and they asked questions and they walked along the road from Galilee to Jerusalem and they asked Jesus questions and they sat around the campfire. Jesus, how can this be? And why did you do this? And they saw firsthand Jesus. But much more importantly, they saw Jesus, he dies, he rises again, and they saw the living Jesus. And then he ascends into heaven, and Philip, it says, all the disciples were up on the mountain together when this happened, and Nathanael would have seen Jesus rise up and ascend into heaven together. And so I think part of the answer of why were these guys willing to give their lives, why was Nathanael willing to be filleted alive, literally, is because they knew the truth. They saw Jesus alive. And a living Jesus after his death makes all the difference in the world. Even when we come to Easter, we have all of these passages that say, if there is no resurrection from the dead, we are of all people hopeless. It's all based upon the resurrection. So for Nathanael and these other guys to see Jesus alive, to see him ascend, that gives us the reason why they were willing to go to their deaths for what they knew to be true. And I believe it's also part of the really good evidence that we have to say these guys really saw him alive. Because no one dies for a lie. No one dies for things that they know aren't true. These 12 didn't get together in the upper room after Jesus died and they said, you know, let's come up with this really good story and let's spread it around and let's see if we can really keep this thing going and maybe we'll ascend to be kings and maybe we'll have leadership in all of this religion. These guys died heinously, terribly, painfully, because they knew what the truth was. And I think for me, when I think about how these guys died and what they were willing to do, it kind of puts in perspective some of the things that I complain about, you know, my so-called difficulties, because I can't imagine standing on top of the firewood, the pyre. The flames are being lit. I know it's going to hurt. And I smile and say, bring it on. I can't imagine doing that. And I can't imagine feeling in the depth of my heart that to give my life right now for Jesus is a very small thing to give. But all these guys, except the Apostle John, all 12 of the apostles, they all died this way because they believed. And I don't think we're going to get to heaven and they're all going to say, you know what, a bummer. I could have lived another 10 years. If I hadn't given my life to Jesus, I could have really lived another 10 years. It would have been great. None of them are going to begrudge what they gave. So may God just never let us take for granted, first, the freedoms that we have in this country. But even more than that, let's not shy away from what we consider to be inconveniences for the cause of Christ. Because I think we dishonor those that were willing to give it all. When we say this little tiny thing that doesn't matter, oh, it's such a big inconvenience for me. And may we never dishonor their sacrifices by being ashamed of the gospel. We get to Romans chapter 1, for instance, 1 Timothy 1. Have you ever been ashamed to be a Christian? To bow your head and pray in public? To stand up for what you believe is right? To stand up for Jesus? I would bet that there are many of us that we have felt in moments, maybe shame is too strong, but a nervousness, shrinking back in the moment. Why do we do that? These guys give us a great example of being courageous in the face of not just little small inconveniences or, oh, someone might talk bad about me, or, oh, they might think I'm a weirdo, or whatever that thing is. These guys said, bring on the fire. I love that about them. Our third disciple we're going to talk about today, a guy named Thomas, but many of us know him as Doubting Thomas. His other name in the New Testament is Didymus, which is really funny because the name Thomas means twin. The name Didymus is a Greek translation of the Hebrew Thomas. It also means twin. So like his name was like twin, I guess. But he's only mentioned in Matthew, Mark, and Luke in the lists of the apostles. He's just listed as one of them. But in the book of John, we get two little snapshots from the life of Thomas. Let me tell you the first one and we'll read the second one. The first one comes near the end of Jesus' earthly ministry, and he and his disciples are in Jerusalem. And you actually know this story very well, because when Lazarus dies, Jesus hangs out for another 4 days. You remember that part of the story? And then he says, okay, let's go see Lazarus. In that exchange in John chapter 11, there's this moment with Thomas where the apostles are with Jesus. And they're like, Jesus, you know, people are going to take your life. If you try to go there, they are going to take your life. Don't you know that all these threats are out there? Don't you know that they're waiting? They're going to snag you along the way. They're going to kill you. And Jesus says, I'm going. Then it says, Thomas says to all the disciples, let's go with him and die. Now, what's so amazing about that is that it seems like he was the only one then willing to die. He was literally ready in that moment to walk those 8 miles and die with Jesus. Tremendous faith. He in that story, we see this like crazy amount of loyalty. And then a few chapters later, Thomas, with all the other disciples, flee. They run away for their life. And you're like, well, what happened, Thomas? Just a couple chapters ago, you're like, let's go and die. And now you're running for your life, afraid. We don't know what happened between the two. But Thomas was certainly, in John 11, willing to die, and only a few chapters later ran for his life. The only other story we know with John is about Thomas is found in the book of John chapter 20. And this is the story where he gets this title, Doubting Thomas. So if you go with me to John chapter 20, I want to read part of this. And I think one of the reasons why we love Thomas is because we can identify with him. Doubts, skepticism. If I can't see with my own eyes, I am not going to believe. I want to read part of the story. John 20. And it's a little bit longer of a section, but starting in verse 19 as we set it up. Here's what it says, John chapter 20, verse 19. It says, on the evening of that day, the first day of the week, the doors being locked where the disciples were for fear of Jesus, Jesus came and stood among them and said to them, peace be with you. When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. Jesus said to them again, peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, even so I am sending you. And when he had said this, he breathed on them and said to them, receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven them. If you withhold forgiveness from any, it is withheld. Now look at verse 24. Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails, and place my finger into the mark of the nails, and place my hand into his side, I will never believe. Now if we just pause right there, this is the exact question where so many people stop when they explore Jesus. How can I believe? How can I know? I want to see with my own eyes. Like, have you ever thought, you know, if Jesus, if you would just show up right here, right now, just for a second, my faith would be so much stronger. That's why we identify with Thomas. We're like, man, I want to stick my finger in the holes. And when I can do that, I can see that you're really true and you're really alive and all of this matters, then I'll have enough faith. This is Thomas. This is his story. Let's keep going. 8 days later, the disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, which I'm just going to put a little parenthesis, who was standing sheepishly in the back row, put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe. Thomas then answered, my Lord and my God. Jesus said to him, have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. It's a wonderful story for lots of reasons. Primarily, I think, because we can so identify with Thomas. But Jesus in his resurrected body really must have been something. And if you just think about Thomas, put your finger here. What was that like? And why would he say, put your hand here on my side, if not for something being there or not being there? And when Thomas puts his finger here and he puts his hand on his side and maybe he checks out his feet, then he exclaims, my Lord and my God, which is really an interesting, that last phrase of Jesus. We don't have time to talk about it, but it says, you know, there's what we think is, man, if we could do like Thomas, if Jesus could show up and we could touch his hands and put our hand on his side and really see he's alive, then we would really believe. But Jesus says, all right, Thomas, you got the goods here. Good job, way to believe. But blessed are those who believe and don't even see. He's talking about us that believe without even having to touch and to see. We don't have time to talk about that. So for such a minor disciple, what's really interesting about the church tradition around this, we know that Thomas went to India. He went there and he spread the gospel. He started all kinds of churches. And there is universal agreement that on the 3rd of July, Thomas was pierced with a lance in India, and he died there. And he's actually buried in this place called Mylapore, India. And we know that he spent all of his life and he planted all kinds of churches that still today in India, they trace their spiritual heritage to Thomas. Now, just as a side note to all of us, David Stitt, who is our second service guy, so if you only ever come to first service, you're like, I never heard of him. So David Stitt, retired missionary and pastor. David Stitt has preached in India at some of these churches that were started 2,000 years ago by Thomas. And he preached in the church that is nearby to where Thomas's bones are buried still today. And I think that's super, super cool. So when he told me that, I'm like, oh, you're going in the sermon. Good stuff. So the last disciple that we're going to talk about before we get to the plus one Matthias is this guy called Simon. Simon the Zealot. In some ways, we're getting from obscure to even more obscure because we know so little about Simon the Zealot. Just a little side note on Bible translation. In Matthew and Mark, in the King James Version only, it says that Simon was a Canaanite, which is an error. It's a mistranslation. Like in Matthew 10:4, Simon the Canaanite and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him, and then it goes on to say more. But this is one of the places where one or two letters makes a big difference. The word is not Canaanite, but the word is Canaanian. Canaanian is simply the word that means zealot. So in Matthew and Mark, he's referred to as Simon the Canaanian, and then in Luke and in Acts, he's referred to as Simon the Zealot, but it's the same word. Certainly he was not a Canaanite. Jesus didn't choose some Gentile Canaanite to join his crew. We know that for sure. What we don't know is what it means. What does it mean for Simon the Zealot? What kind of zealot was he? And that we don't really know. There was a group in the first century called the Zealots. They were kind of like a side kind of political group. They sought ways to bring about the kingdom and the overthrow of Rome, but bring back the Jewish kingdom. He may have belonged to this group. And these zealots, they would go around and they would assassinate and they would do all these things. He may have belonged to that group, but we don't know for sure. But probably that zealot group probably began after Jesus died, a little bit to mid to later first century. So he may or may not have belonged to that group. He may have just been really zealous for the Mosaic Law. He may have been really zealous for Jesus and all that Jesus said. Maybe he was just an overachiever. We don't know. But evidently, somewhere along the way, he became known as Simon the Zealot. He is only mentioned in the four lists. Nowhere else. No other story. No other pieces about him. He's only in the four lists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and then Acts, only in those lists. But I was thinking, as I was putting this together, how interesting the walks along the road and the sitting around the campfire must have been with Simon the Zealot, overthrow Rome, and Matthew the tax collector, let's work for Rome, sitting around the campfire talking together. That must have made for some very interesting conversations. Tradition says that he, after Pentecost, that he went to Egypt, preached the gospel there, started churches there, and then he joined Thaddeus and Judas, in Persia. And there he died with Judas by being cut in half with a saw, which is interesting. If you read Hebrews chapter 11, when he says that the world is not worthy of these men who have lived in caves and they went around. And then there's this little phrase, and some were sawed in half. Could it be a reference to how Simon died? We don't know. So that leaves us with just one last obscure disciple, the most obscure of all. This is Matthias. And I want to read part of his story in Acts chapter 1, how he got into the crew. Acts chapter 1. Acts chapter 1, verse 23. This is how they are trying to figure out what guy's going to join. He's going to take the open spot that Judas Iscariot left to bring that number back up to 12. Here's what it says in verse 23. This is Acts 1, 23. And they put forward to Joseph, called Barsabbas, who was also called Justus, and Matthias. And they prayed and they said, "You, Lord, you who know the hearts of all, show which one of these two you have chosen to take the place of this ministry and," we didn't talk about it, "the apostleship," that's that word, "from which Judas turned aside to go to his own place." Then they cast lots, and the lot fell to Matthias, and he was numbered with the 11 apostles. So Matthias was not part of the original 12. Now, this is significant for a couple reasons. It's significant because Jesus never chose Matthias. The other 12 had these moments where Jesus said, come follow me, and you come follow me, and you fishermen, you come follow me. Matthias never had that. So I often wonder if he kind of felt like a second-class apostle. He's only ever mentioned here. This is the only place in all the Bible he's mentioned. He's not mentioned anywhere else. He met the requirements that Peter set forth. Someone who was with us from the time of Jesus' baptism all the way up to his ascension. There are a lot of people that believe that Matthias was actually Zacchaeus, who changed his name after coming to Christ, but we have no evidence of that. The bigger question with Matthias is this: should he have been added? Because we don't read anywhere of Jesus saying, hey, one of you is going to fall away, another one needs to be added. Peter, it seems, in Acts chapter 1, is the one that came up with the idea. So there's been all this speculation for all these years of whether or not this was Jesus' idea or whether this was Peter's idea. We won't know, I think, until we get to heaven. But what is compelling about Matthias, at least to me, is that he followed Jesus with no notoriety. He, by tradition, was one of the 70 that was sent out. He could have said things like, how come I'm not an apostle? How come I'm not in the 12? Or he could have said, why am I good enough to be in the 70, but I'm not good enough, Jesus, for you to choose me in the 12? He could have come to this Acts 1 moment and said, no, if I wasn't good enough then, I'm not good enough now. We don't see any of that kind of attitude, any of that kind of latent kind of sin nature stuff coming out in the story at all. He just, it seems, was faithful. He just followed along, gave his life to Christ, worked in obscurity. There's not even a good church tradition around how he died. He was so obscure. And I think that's a good place for us to end, because I think all of these disciples, they were kind of like Matthias. They were just common. And in my mind, when Jesus came along and he starts calling the disciples, you know, from the boat or from the tax collector booth or wherever, and Jesus says, come follow me, I wonder how many of them thought, you talking to me? Why me? I'm not educated. I'm not aristocracy. I'm not in the priesthood. Don't you know all of my flaws? Really, you want me. And so I think when we look at these nine apostles, and it really all of these kind of hardly known characters that we've been looking at, what it tells us is that there is this great untapped resource in the Christian world of the masses of us that just feel ordinary. We don't feel like we have all these great gifts. We're not going to get up and do all these great things. We just kind of feel common. And if Jesus walked in here and he chose us, we would be the ones going, you talking to me? You talking to this person behind me? Have you ever just felt unqualified? Common. No different than anyone else. Average. And I think churches are filled with people that feel that way, and I think it becomes a roadblock to them serving the Lord, because they're like, well, I can't do anything. I don't have the great gifts. You can even sit here on a Sunday morning and you see all the people up on the stage and I'm not going to sing like that. I can't play the piano. I can't play the drums. Some of you think that's a good thing. I can't do any of those things. And so, you know, where's my place? And what we find time after time in the story of the Bible is that God takes these ordinary people with extraordinary faith and just a tiny sliver of willingness, and then he does extraordinary things with them. Common people, ordinary people, with extraordinary faith and a sliver of willingness to try, to do, to step out in faith, to take a risk. And he takes these people and he says, I've got something great for you. So listen, if you ever sit here and you feel a little bit ordinary, a little bit average, a little bit just like everybody else, I just want you to know that you might be in a very dangerous spot, because you might be that next ordinary person that Jesus says, you're my next great person to do something great in the Hastings area. Don't ever think that because you don't have some extraordinary gift or you can't get up in front of people and do X, Y, and Z or Oh, if I had that gift, then I really could. Or if I could do that, then I really could. God just seems to take ordinary people with a little bit of willingness and does extraordinary things with them. So be careful if you think you're ordinary. You might be exactly who Jesus is looking for that next great thing around here. Don't ever believe that being ordinary disqualifies you from serving the Lord.